Session number 8939, Captain Ian Hamerton, Reel 7.
I think you're going to tell me about the perils of starting up the Vickers medium tank.
Well, we had four of these in the 42nd Battalion at Wallingham in 1939, and we were taken out for what I can only describe as rides, and to see how they worked, because they were completely new to the new recruits. It was quite a palaver starting them up. It took all the crew, as far as I remember. The driver sat in the driver's seat and operated the hand-operated magneto, which was placed right next to a bulkhead with either bolt heads or rivets. So as he whirled the little handle round, it took the skin off his knuckles very easily. But with the other hand, he had to insert his arm in an opening next to him to seal off by hand the opening to the right-hand carburettor of the Ricardo engine. Another member of the crew had to crawl through an opening from the turret area into the left-hand side of the engine and put his hand over the left-hand carburettor intake. Both had fire extinguishers to hand, and the rest of the crew were dispersed in various strategic positions, also armed with fire extinguishers. Anyway, on the word go, the two chaps on the starting handle, which I seem to remember was out in the front somewhere, started to turn the engine over on half compression, and then there was a shout and you popped it over to full compression. You whirled the magneto, and with luck the engine would fire. With bad luck it would spit back flames, and this is where the fire extinguishers came in. But in the end it would start. But it was quite a performance.
What was it like starting up the Sherman?
Oh, no problem at all. The Shermans we had the multi-engine, a petrol engine with, I think it was five or six cylinder lorry engines bolted to a common crankcase with a common clutch and flywheel. And it started readily on the self-starter. The driver had to wait to see if the ignition lights went out or went on or whatever it was for all of the five engines.
Were there any other tanks that were a fire risk on starting?
Not to my knowledge. The only comparable one to the old Vickers medium, I suppose, was the Heavy Dragon, as it was called, which was more or less a turretless medium. Wasn't quite the same, but it was a gun tractor, really. But that was a pig to start. You had to take all the sparking plugs out, put them in a dish with some petrol, set fire to it and heat them up, and then try and grab hold of them and screw them back in the cylinders. And again, the starting handle was in a most awkward place in the bowels of the tank, of the carrier thing. And you had to try and turn the engine on half compression and then put over the full compression lever, and with luck it would start. But that was in 39, that was a relic from between wars.
It's often said that crews in Shermans felt somewhat insecure because they had got petrol engines under them rather than diesel. Did you ever think about that?
No, to tell you the truth, I didn't. I don't think it ever crossed our mind. What we were more concerned with was the difference in thickness of armour between ourselves and Churchill's, for example, because we knew the front of the Churchill was much had a much thicker armour than we had, although we noted on several occasions the Sherman smooth contours enabled some shots, at any rate, to bounce off. On the subject of the petrol, I was amazed after the night attack in August to find one of my tanks that had wandered away from the line of advance. He'd been shot, had a shot through the hull just in front of the right hand filler cap, and it went clean through the turret and came out through the driver's side of the hull. It brewed the tank up, the ammunition blew up, the crew of course were killed, but when I saw the tank a few days later, the engine compartment was completely unburnt and there was still petrol in both tanks.
Presumably it would depend upon how much petrol there was. If there'd been a lot of vapour, that would have caught.
I imagine so, yes. It's quite a business, of course, refuelling, because we didn't refuel from Bowser's. We had to refuel from those wretched 5-gallon tins, and it took quite a number of 5-gallon tins to load up.
Why couldn't you refuel from Bowser's?
Well, as far as I know, there weren't any.
How long did it take to actually fill the tank up using the 5-gallon tins?
I've never really timed it. If we were nearly empty, I suppose it could be half an hour, something like that. I don't honestly know.
What about replenishment of ammunition? How was that done?
Well, that was also brought up to us by the gallant RASC. I say gallant because they came up under fire sometimes with both petrol and ammo. And it was a question of a chain gang passing ammo up from the ground or from the lorry and down into the turret. I might say that when we first loaded up with ammunition in the New Forest before the invasion, this was when we knew we were really on the way, we were given more ammunition than the ammo racks would hold. And it was quite a problem trying to find a home for the extra HE, extra smoke, extra AP, 2-inch mortar bombs, the phosphorus bombs, 303 and 0.5 Browning ammunition. And we ended up with quite a collection of HE and AP on the floor of the turret, and we had to tread on it, and in fact on many occasions slept on it, and odd boxes of Browning and so on. There was a rather amusing incident, if I can digress again. We were loading up our tanks. Each crew was very busy doing this, and morning break came along and we knocked off for a smoke and a cup of tea, and when we came back, I said to my troop, for goodness sake, before you stow anything else, check that your guns are clear, that you haven't put any in, because I'd had a word, somebody had said we run out of space, so we shove one up the spout ready. So I said, for goodness sake, check that. And one of my tanks, which was parked under the trees, only a matter of yards from mine, the gunner did check everything. He had in fact stowed everything, and his thought for checking was to press the button. Well, fortunately, the first button he pressed was actually the trigger of the 2-inch bomb thrower. and he had put a bomb in that. And of course, when you loaded that thing, it broke like a shotgun on the inside of the tank. You loaded the shell and closed the breech again, and of course that cocked it. Well, unfortunately, the driver had been cleaning out his compartment and had taken his seat out and put it up on top of the turret, right over the mouth of the 2-inch bomb thrower. So when Dave pressed the trigger, the bomb went up the barrel, hit the seat, which was a heavy thing, and stayed in the barrel, emitting clouds of smoke. It wasn't phosphorus smoke, it was the smoke that burnt all the way out as it came out, left a trail. But the thing burnt away in the barrel of the bomb thrower, and of course it filled the tank with smoke. There was a shout of fire. I emerged from my tank to see the one next to me streaming smoke, and somebody said, "Dave's still trying to get out." So somebody and I hopped over and managed to grab hold of him by his braces. You know that armoured people always wore a belt, the equipment belt plus the two braces for this very purpose. And we hauled him out, and he was gasping and spluttering, but the 2-inch bomb thrower was glowing red hot. But there was nothing we could do, we just had to let it burn itself out. And of course that was a US bomb thrower on that tank, which we had to get replaced. But quite an exciting moment that was.
How long would it take to get something like that replaced?
I believe I'm right in saying that we got that replaced within a matter of couple of days or so, because I'm pretty certain that they had it to go into action with on D-Day. I'm positive they did. Getting things replaced was, I think, depended a lot on the circumstances. For instance, my tank, which got waterlogged on the beach, as I've already said, I didn't get a replacement for several weeks, but then that was because, as I understood at the time, the flails were not immediate priority. I think gun tanks took priority for replacement. But in any case, we cut down from five troops of five tanks to four troops of five tanks sometime after D-Day. I can't remember when. May have been a few days, may have been weeks. So we were able to share out the spare tanks, as it were.
Presumably you'd had five troops on D-Day to provide for possible casualties and breakdowns.
I hadn't looked at it like that. I think it was more to make up the assault teams. As I think I've said before, there were two flails in one assault team. Two of my troops flails in one assault team, and three in the other. That's the one I was in.
You're mentioning all these different sorts of ammunition on the floor of the tank. How did you distinguish between the different sorts when you were actually firing them?
Well, the AP was easy because the nature of the shell as such. The HE was also easy because it had a setting ring for the fuse, so that we could use it for airburst as well. And the smoke, I've got a funny feeling in my mind that the smoke was flat-headed, but I must be wrong on that one. Obviously there were the shells were painted with coloured bands, which I can't remember what they are now. But
was it always sufficiently light in the tank, in the turret, to distinguish between one colour and another?
I think it must have been, because I don't think we ever made a mistake.
You mentioned also being shot at. What sort of ranges were used? What range would an anti-tank gun engage usually?
I think that depended a great deal on the terrain. I mean, the 88 could pick us off at 1,500 metres. When we attacked the radar station at Douvres-la-Delivrande, I found afterwards there was a 50mm anti-tank gun right in front of where I was, the diversionary part of the attack, and he was a matter of 75 yards away. We weren't. He fired because when I visited the site later, there were some empty shell cases there, one of which I still have. But as far as I know, we didn't suffer any casualties from him.
I think the last event you described was flailing around Bernières-sur-Mer for the Canadians so they could advance and get going. And that presumably was on D-Day itself. What happened on D plus one?
Now, this is where my memory gets very confused, or rather blank, I would say. There are isolated things I can remember. I remember that after D-Day, we moved near to another little inland place called Revier. And I can remember walking down the road with some of the crew just to look in a French village. We were hailed by some young ladies from an upper window of a house who invited us in, but we declined the invitation, I remember. I think we were still a little bit cautious about the locals. Most of the local people had been evacuated from the coast, and we weren't too sure about the people who'd been left. That could have been D plus one. Probably was. I know that some of my troop, and I didn't myself take part in this because I hadn't got a tank, but some of my troop were designated for beach clearance, and this has only recently been brought to my notice through that film which showed one of our flails at Bernières-sur-Mer, and I've spoken to one of the crew and he reminded me of this, that they were clearing some of those thick minefields just above the sea wall along that part of the coast where all the houses had been demolished, or most of the houses had been demolished. But they were for 1 or 2, possibly 3 days, I can't remember, under the command of the beachmaster for these tasks. Within a week, we had been brought together. Most of the regiment had been brought together in the little hamlet, or an orchard outside the little hamlet of Cresseron, and the tanks were dispersed alongside some very thick hedgerows with quite large elm trees and a good deal of cover. And that was to be our regimental base until August, as it turns out. When we were first there, we were about the only people in the vicinity. I can remember the farmer having his cows tethered to pickets in the field and alongside us. Our regimental sanitary orderly constructed some superb loos in a field of mustard, which was part of part of the orchard. From there, we would sally forth on various jobs. I myself, with my troop, and by this time I had got another tank, within a matter of days, I was sent over the Orne to link up with the Airborne Division.
Just your troop?
Just my troop. And I remember we moved down to Benneville in the late afternoon, and it was pitch black night by the time we came to cross the Bailey Bridge, which had been erected downstream from Pegasus Bridge as it is now. And I can remember that was the first time that most of my drivers, and certainly myself, had negotiated a Bailey. And we found that we had to raise the jib up with the rams, and that there was about an inch and a half clearance either side of the tank, and it was necessary for the commander of each tank to walk in front backwards over the bridge with a lighted cigarette in each, cupped in each hand, to guide the driver. The approach to the bridge was a bit of a twisted one, but we got over without incident, and it wasn't till we got to the other side, really, that one realised that the bridge was being shelled and that there was bits of shrapnel and stuff flying around in all directions, because by this time, of course, the Jerrys were concentrating a great deal on this particular sector with the bridges. And arriving over the other side, we made our way through fields and orchards, and I remember we had to stop for the rest of the night in an apple orchard or some such, and there was the most incredible firework display going on. We stayed within the tanks most of the time, and then as it got to first light, I had to go and liaise with the infantry who were preparing an attack. I think it must have been the 51st Highland Div, or certainly it's a Scottish unit, who'd come to relieve the airborne. So that will probably give you the date. And I walked up a sunken road, and as I did so, the infantry, who were already sort of lining both sides of this road, trained their rifles, Brens, on me, and I felt extremely uncomfortable, and they looked most belligerent. And then somebody said to me, "Are you British?" And I said, "Yes, why?" And he said, "Because you look like a Jerry." And of course I realised then I was wearing the blue dungaree overalls which the officers in the 22nd Dragoon had up to that time worn. I was also wearing my flying boots with these things tucked into them. The Tang helmet is not unlike the German paratrooper's helmet. And I must have looked rather an odd sight to these characters. From then on, I never wore any blue overalls.
What did you wear?
I got hold of a pair of the standard khaki denim overalls, the tank type overalls, which were then issued. We didn't get the marvellous tank suits until we were in Holland, a long time later.
How did the blue ones differ from the standard denim khaki?
How did they differ? Well, they were just like an ordinary mechanic's blue overall. They had pockets. I don't think they had a knee pocket, as far as I remember. They were the sort of jeans blue, that perhaps a bit darker than that.
What was the helmet like? What was it for?
What was it for? So psychological, I think, support for the upper part of the body. It was a round, no, not round, it was an oval shape, basically, rimless helmet, unlike the infantry helmet or the Canadian helmet. We usually had a piece of camouflage netting, close mesh netting on it. It also, the tank one also, carried earphones incorporated in the strap. For some of them, not for all of them. No, I'm wrong. That was a DR's helmet, wasn't it? That had leather ear flaps. We had a separate head harness for earphones and microphone, separate from the helmet. Yeah, that's right. There was one slight snag with the helmet. If you had your head out of the top, as you usually did, and half of the cupola closed down, you couldn't get your head back in without turning sideways. And on another occasion in the Reichswald, when the tank was struck by an enemy shell, and I had my head out of the top, the shock of the, it was an AP, the shock of it hitting the gun caused me to drop inside the tank, and the fall broke my chin strap and left the helmet up top, and I was in a tangle of earphones and microphone cables on the floor of the tank. However,
was it supposed to defend you against the effects of enemy action, or was it supposed to just stop you from banging your head when you're jolting around?
Oh no, it wasn't a crash helmet in the sense, in that sense at all. No, it was supposed to protect your head from splinters and that sort of thing. I suppose it did. The only time I've had occasion to think about that was when a mortar bomb landed on the turret as I was getting in. But that blew in my face, not on my head. I don't know what the helmet would have done. We didn't wear it inside the tank.
Did you carry a personal weapon?
Yes. I had a very nice little Smith & Wesson 3.8 revolver. I think the only time I fired it in anger